point. He said it. I'm up on the second floor. He said it with his head down. I'm looking at his hat, and he's staring at the fucking mud on the like close up, like he's got bad eyesight, staring at the mud on the carpet. I am assuming pissed off, and he corrects me while keeping his head still down.
So he's not looking at you.
He's not looking at me. He's just yelling it up, so to speak, bouncing it off the dirty carpet. He's more. What? Yeah, I was right above him. He could have looked up and seen me, but he may not have known that I was right up there because maybe my voice came around the corner but of the office. But I watched him stare at the mud and say those words. No, no, it's too long. Hand signals.
That's funny.
And in some ways he's right, but I used to like just the irony of hand signals for the blind. You can't see the hand, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And that means it's tactile communication, which turns out to be what Cosmic Awareness said I was about back in October 8th, 1969. I was very good at transpersonative communication. That's like a level of nonverbal ESP communication. And that would be hand signals for the blind. You can't see what I'm saying. You can feel it. All right, enough about you, Brian. Let's move on to Derrida.
That was great.
I'm glad you remember those stories, though, Brian. That's
good. Very relevant to the McLuhan new coach app.
And, you know, just to finish that, so we're walking across Queens Park. We get on the streetcar, and we go up to St. Clair Avenue, and we go along and get off very near the church he went to on St. Clair Avenue West. This is St. Clair and Bathurst going west. And so we walk into this building, and that is where Don Gay, Carolyn? Yeah, Don Gay did acupuncture in 1975. Carolyn meets Don Gay 15 years later, 1990, and starts working with him a little bit, becomes his friend. Now, right beside that building, which I think was 235 St. Clair Avenue West, is the building that the Evergreen started in. In 1974, it was like 219 St. Clair Avenue West. 235 was a big building. There might have been a 222 or 223 in between. So in that building, and we're doing it in 75, McLuhan is going to have a session with the Aries 1 year later in 1976. So that's the only time I ever walked into some public thing out on the street with McLuhan. Everything else was always in his office. But to actually walk along, get on the subway with him, go up to maybe it was a streetcar or whatever it was, and then go to this building, and it turned out to be a very significant building in my life 5 years later. Very, very tight and tapered, the tunnel of Bob's life.
Is there any writing about McLuhan's visits to the Evergreens in his letters or anything?
No. I only know about it because Mary found a transcript of the Evergreen session where everybody in the family is discussed. And she never read it. It was too personal. But she found it in her own collection. She never had the session. She was in San Francisco. So this happened in Toronto in about 76. And Mary was amazed to find it. They must have sent her a copy because she would read about what they said about every one of her sisters and brothers and mothers and fathers and all that. I have no idea. We don't know if Marshall was there. There's no record of whether he was there or not, but he might have been. And we don't know how they found out about it, how they found out about the Evergreens. That's 4 years before I knew them. But McLuhan was an expert on Edgar Casey, so he looked into mediumships more than people realized.
Right.
And, you know, Michael Blake Reed himself, like around 1972, 73, somewhere in there, he was an advertising executive in Toronto, and he went to a conference that featured McLuhan and maybe Bucky Fuller, but at least McLuhan. And he said he spent the conference that night, he spent a lot of time with McLuhan. But he had no clue who McLuhan was or what he would say. I mean, you might have found out during that conference that McLuhan was a famous Canadian or something. But he did have he said, one of his most interesting nights, you know, talking to McLuhan as an advertising guy. That's Michael Blake Reed, another tiny tunnel connection.
Homeopathic.
Yes.
Shrinking.
Existence. Shrinking homeopaths.
Baroque spirals.
Xenocritus, Bob, tiny note.
My address is 224 Emerald.
Is it?
Yeah.
Really? 224?
Emerald,
wow,
that's, yeah.
That's April 22nd, man. That's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Okay, should we get back to this?
Yeah.
Gene, what were you going to say? What was Gene going to say like a half hour ago?
Oh, we're way beyond. We're way
okay.
beyond.
Okay. Okay.
Now, when they say the word, when Barbara says the word representation, that's visualization. They always talk
uh-huh.
about representation, and representation is useless now. That means like a visualization or visual space.
And Genesco is using that too?
Everybody uses the word representation. You know, that's the word that people, that students come out of postmodern studies. They all know we're in a non-representation world.
Right.
But they don't have the meaty dynamics and subtleties. That's snow. You know, with McLuhan,
right.
you get 50 kinds of snow. But with postmodern studies in university, you come up with just the word snow, representation. You don't know the 50 gradations of it.
Mm-hmm.
What were you going to say?
I like the phrase, a copy without an original.
Right, that's from Baudrillard.
I like that for the postmodern wrap-up.
You know what that's from? That's from genetics. When you make clones, you lose the original
mm-hmm.
somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. Okay, so writing, on the other hand, is considered by the logocentric system to be only a representation of speech, a secondary substitute designed for use only when speaking is impossible. Writing is thus a second-rate activity that tries to overcome distance by making use of it. The writer puts his thought on paper, distancing it from himself, transforming it into something that can be read by someone far away, even after the writer's death. This inclusion of death, distance, and difference is thought to be a corruption of the self-presence of meaning, to open meaning up to all forms of adulteration which immediacy would have prevented.
So look at that. You guys all here? Let me check our everybody's present?
Yes.
And
yes.
Brian? And Michael? See, for Brian, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. He may not be able to keep going. He might have dropped off. Okay. See how this is an analysis of the materiality of the media of writing. It describes, like children stuff, the writer puts his thought on paper. He distances himself. Transforming, these are basic facts that no one thinks about anymore of the fact of writing, what it entails. So this looking at the materiality of writing is what McLuhan brought in. So they're mm-hmm. media ecologists. She's being a media ecologist here and talking about the difference between writing and speech.
Brian's statement, media content is 1/4 distortion of ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a wordy word, distortion. It's like a chatterbox who picks up some ideas from media ecology and then just goes on and on because they like to hear themselves talk.
So this gets to the original paragraph I read earlier. In the course of his critique, Derrida does not simply reverse this value system and say that writing is better than speech. Rather, he attempts to show that the very possibility of opposing the two terms on the basis of presence versus absence or immediacy versus representation is an illusion, since speech is already structured by difference and distance as much as writing is. The very fact that a word... Okay, so that's interesting to me when I'm thinking about the Ganesco stuff. Because it's saying speech is already, like, conceptual representational speech, which content speech versus a signified speaking or tones or bleeps or whatever. This is saying speech is already structured by difference and distance as much as writing is. So I like that's kind of, it's collapsing and folding up what you said, literate speech and literate writing, kind of into the same drawer. And it can kind of just put those away and show that it's kind of the same type of conceptual notion. Okay, so then he goes on.
Yeah, so let me say this. So Derrida does not simply reverse this value system and say that writing is better than speech. So there's Derrida dancing on the toes of McLuhan. And he actually said this in 1971 in Montreal. Don Thiel cites the transcript or the event, whatever evidence there is of it. And Derrida puts down McLuhan and says he got it backwards. But once McLuhan had laid down the eternal rules of normal reality, say, all you could do is say, well, no, I disagree. It's not green. It's black. So he switches things. But he's still trying to – he's still stuck within the world of McLuhan, and McLuhan's already done. So there he attempts to show the very possibility of opposing the two terms on the basis of presence versus absence or immediacy versus representation. So he doesn't go into that as a visual effect. He says it's an illusion. Now, that's not a useful word because media dynamics are real. They affect us. So to bring in the concept of illusion is a judgmental muddying thing. It's right in a way to say it, but he's not giving the reason, or we don't know whether he understands it the way I'm suggesting. Since speech is already structured by difference and distance as much as writing is, well, that's, I don't know what it means, difference and distance. If there is that, that's on a very minute level. It's forgetting the formal differences in sensory aspects between speech and writing, and now saying, well, we have the idea of difference and distance. Well, there's difference and distance when you speak. You bring in extra semantic meanings that muddies the thing. It seems to be not a big deal. It seems to be trivial, this point they're making, compared to the point they don't say.
Well, Ganesco seems to update. He seems to apply in his... The semiotics you've been reading from is updated. It's current. I mean,
how do you know that? You're remembering what I said, what I quoted?
Before the show started, Bob, I'm referring this whole show back to what you went through last Sunday night, because I wasn't there, so I was catching up. And
yeah, so what you're just citing, you remember.
Yes.
Yeah.
I got my notes. You had said
Yeah, and Ganesco Ganesco generally shows Derrida to be a bit limited to what Ganesco is all about.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's trying to go past Derrida, and he's using Baudrillard and what he calls the critical semioticians, the critical guys who actually don't fall for semiotics. They're critical of it. So here's Ganesco inventing a new field, critical semiotics. That means critical of semiotics or semiology. Derrida is still back in the semiotics world, hasn't made the leap. So he's, as they say, given short shrift in the book.
Well, now, granted, this wasn't this the 80s, published in the 80s?
This essay might have been the 70s. Well, the essays themselves, I don't know. Does it have a date?
81.
Okay, but when were they written? This is when it's gathered together. Does it say in the introduction when these were written?
True. This was a translation.
I imagine it's in this book of grammatology, 1976. So let's say this is 70 stuff.
Mm-hmm.
From
okay.
Derrida.
Yeah, it's microscopic. It's splitting hairs, like you were saying, about...
Yeah, visually biased splitting hair.
Yeah, it's Let's funny. They're dancing. They're like dancing around, dancing in McLuhan's world, but kind of ignoring McLuhan and just kind of like sticking to their visual stuff and talking a lot about it.
To make the point that McLuhan didn't make, or to make the opposite of McLuhan, using McLuhan to make the opposite of McLuhan.
But definitely dancing in McLuhan's world, because you can't. Like you said, the eternal laws or the observations of environments that just are like the weather, you know, noticing the form of writing itself or things like that. So they're definitely, it's an odd overlay between those two worlds. And they're not necessarily copacetic.
Hmm.
And you could say, maybe that's what all the arts of communication in the 70s, 80s were overlaying. Like I used to say, we never left 1945. We're just overlaying cliche probes or slight nuances of the archetypes that had already been laid out in every medium.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, the digital world does bring in a new aspect, though. When you get in full-flown use of the digital, then people can collage in a new level or do something with it, make interesting visual effects. But before that, you're just doing 50 kinds. This is 50 kinds of McLuhan.
This is rehashing. It's not hacking. It's rehashing, not rehacking.
Yeah. So, well, it is hacking because you're trying to make a claim that McLuhan wouldn't agree
sure,
with.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
So you're what did I say it was? What was that word? 50 kinds of McLuhan. This is 50 kinds. So there are 50 kinds of postmodernism. Is 50 kinds of anti-McLuhan using McLuhan.
That's great. That's very postmodern of them, isn't it?
Yeah, very postmodern.
Anti-McLuhan using McLuhan.
Yeah.
That,
or
yeah,
they can't get out of his methodology.
Exactly.
They're going to bring in concepts to muddy it and make a point that McLuhan wouldn't agree with. It was almost like the Marxists said, okay, the Catholics got there first. We've got to fucking destroy this Catholic and get Marxists back in there, Marxist thinkers, and take over media ecology. We won't call it that. We'll call it texting or something. What do they call it? The cultural studies, post-structuralism. See, McLuhan looked at the structures of media, and we're moving into a post-structural environment McLuhan was aware of. That's why Finney's Wake was good at describing it. But these guys made it into a discipline, a bureaucracy,
mm-hmm.
post-structuralism.
Yeah.
This sounds like just an environment of let's talk about it some more. The last sentence in the paragraph that what you guys are on is just – reiterating something. I almost want to say, what's your point? He says, the illusion of the self-presence of meaning or of consciousness is thus produced by the repression of the differential structures from which they spring.
That's Logos.
Yeah, that's what happens when you're a Marxist Freudian. See, he's doing Freud in the previous sentence and quoting Freud and then Marx and then structuralism, which is De Saussure, that guy, and then trying to be past it. Yeah, like the illusion of a self-presence of meaning or of consciousness is that. Now, is
basically
consciousness defined as self-presence of meaning or is consciousness meaning? See, he's not specifying it.
Yeah.
Or the self-presence of consciousness. The illusion of self-presence of meaning.
Right, and it reminds me of what you've said is that McLuhan, the act of creating is having an experience and responding to the experience. So any response, you're not excluding anything there, but you're going to you're going to have, you might have multiple responses, but you, it's not about excluding
any
response.
It's not the experience of experience. It's the epistemology of experience.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. The dividing of words to try to articulate the experience, just
right.
Microscopically dividing.
So the illusion of the self-presence of meaning or of content, in other words, the illusion of speech is that's produced by the repression of the differential structures from which they, what is they? The structures, I guess.
The differential structures
from which they spring. Now, the repression of the differential structures is actually what McLuhan does or what he's doing. I can't tell whether it's Andy McLuhan or Pro McLuhan, but when you're dealing with structures and the differences of structures and where they spring from, which is words, and you repress it, that's Derrida. So he's saying speaking is produced by Derrida, who refuses to speak and will write. The illusion of the self-presence of meaning overcoming is thus produced by the repression of the differential structures from which they spring.
Well, wasn't he just saying that he's making the point that Derrida misses that writing is no different than speech. So then he's saying the illusion of consciousness, the illusion that we actually have self-presence of meaning. So that
illusion
is
produced by the fact you don't have consciousness.
By repressing something, and I don't know.
Yeah.
By the repression.
Well, he's repressing McLuhan. The illusion of the self-presence of meaning or of consciousness. That's, in other words, you're saying, I don't give a fuck what you say. Write it out, like Brian said. Write it out. If you're going to talk to me, write it up. I want to have non-univocal communication with you. Or I don't know.
Yeah.
Or the opposite. Words to get. They can't figure out what someone means when they talk, right? It can be they don't want to open up to many meanings. Was that said earlier?
Well, it almost feels like he's pointing out something that's pointless, you know. Saying, but he missed this, you know.
Well, that's all you can do after the 70s, after the 60s. Everything's been pointless ever since in all media. And you just wealth is made by ignorance.
By critiquing.
I hear the logos in that statement, the illusion of self-presence and meaning or of consciousness. So this thing, this id, this other thing that comes.
Oh, interesting.
That I create words written or spoken from is thus produced by the repression of the differential structures from which they spring. So it's like, am I here because I speak? Am I here because I write? Is there something that comes from? Isn't that's kind of part of what it's saying too? So it's like it's the visual bias creating identity from the visual bias because there's a repression of differential structure
of the other stuff.
You
get stuck in visual bias when you forget the other modalities. You repress the differential structures. If that's what he means by differential structures. Yeah. So he says in the previous paragraph, to open meaning up to all forms of adulteration, which immediacy would have prevented. So they're saying that writing allows more meanings to happen. See, if you bring in corruption of the self-presence of meaning, to open meaning up to all forms of adulteration, which immediacy would have prevented. So they're against the multi-leveled aspects of writing. McLuhan says the definition of reading is guessing. So you guess at these different meanings. As I would say, you can't ask the person who did the writing, whatever that is,
who wrote the writing.
Finding his wake. Now look at this an argument around response. Finding his wake, right? It's only different levels. So Derrida says, that's right. Finney's Wake is a book written properly because it's confusing, adulterating, single meaning. And that is the very text, the very thing that McLuhan says, but from the opposite order of words.
What is McLuhan saying? Can you say that to give context?
Derrida is But Lewis saying, I'm trying to point out that you listen to a radio program. It's oral, not a book. Derrida is saying, no, the fact that the book is more important than the orality that's embedded in every sentence. It's a trivial. Like, you know, I hold up this radio program, and there's, no, it's a movie. Well, it could be both. No, it's way more important that it's a movie than it is speech. It's a silly argument by a nitpicker in a classroom.
It's an
over-evaluation of a medium.
Yes, and this is all you can be when you're in the culture war, culture game. You can only dance the other guy's toes. Derrida has to say, we're different from the British. He makes up an illusionary difference to make the French team or whatever he's part of, the Marx guys, different from the other people. You can't make any differences in tactile space. The wealth is made by old differences that are replayed constantly, old media, old differences, inside an obliteration and a oneness that is a threat to every form of identity and culture.
So how is Derrida a Malthusian satirist of academia in what we're discussing now? Because it seems...
Let me try to answer that right away. So Derrida is celebrating the fact that you have all kinds of confusion when you read, and that's good. Whereas the dominant culture, when he's writing science, is trying to say, well, this means this. We've proven it. They want a single presence of meaning. And Derrida says, well, that's speech-based reality, because it takes a little sensory aspect that when you're talking to someone, you guys know what they're saying. Hear it without the translation, the schizophrenic effect of the phonetic alphabet, which removes the sound and you don't know what he said. So it's a confusing, it's actually a tactile response to the orality literacy debate. Because he's operating and you'll see most artists, successful people from the 70s on, are actually tactile. And they're not what they appear to be. And any dialectic they got going.
Yeah, that could be seen. That scene in this sentence, as soon as there is meaning, there's difference. That's tactile.
Right.
Derrida's word for this lag inherent in any signifying act is difference. The French verb differ, which means both to defer and to differ, which is
that's tactile contrast. So difference is his crazy French word for tactility.
Yeah. So in a way, I mean, we're not even reading Derrida yet, which is fun. But this is all just, I mean, this is a good way to go over the overview, the intro. But
well, we interpret what his audience, what his community thinks he said. That's more important than what he said. What he said is fucking impossible. It's probably like reading it that way. He's going to leave it open-ended.
Right.
So
a
good reader like Barbara gives us the details so we don't get lost in the details of Derrida.
Yeah. I like that, the tactile response to the...
That's why I read a lot of criticism.
Literate.
I like reading criticism because I find out what someone's saying another person said, and then I get ideas from that, rather than spending a year reading Nietzsche, which is a long read. Let's just read what other people say. Since it's bullshit anyways, it's not. I can live in the present where everything's disappeared, so I'll just pretend to go back and engage appearance and do it sort of superficially.
Right. Yeah, there's no conclusion to make anyway, so might as well just get the...
Go along with what to say. Yeah, we agree with you, Barbara. Yeah, continue, Barbara. Very good, Barbara. Yeah, very well, good point, Barbara. Yeah, very nice point. Hey, you want to be... I'm going to interview you, Barbara.
Bob, this gives me a whole different perspective on years ago, your book reviews with Katie Thomas.
Yes.
Which were often critiques, one author critiquing another author. You guys were critiquing that critique.
Yeah. So what is it that happened then that got illustrated right now?
My perspective of that whole time. You know, back then I was like, what the hell? Why are they, you know, why are they basically bashing these authors about this stupid new age information?
Why didn't you understand why we were bashing them?
I just didn't see the significance in it at all. And
oh, now you realize it wasn't significant. We were just dancing on
their toes. And you just said, I'd rather read somebody else's analysis and talk about that. And I can talk about anything at any time. It just put the whole thing in a different
perspective. Okay, so now you know. Yes. Now you see through what I was doing. Okay, so where are we at? You were to differ and to defer. What Derrida attempts to demonstrate is that this difference inhabits the very core of what appears to be immediate and present. That's what tactility is. It's about the interplay of everything, and it's not a sense. It is the very core, which is the nothingness, of what appears to be immediate and present, the interplay of consciousness and its sensory dynamics. Even in the seemingly non-linguistic – what?
Simply put, then, it's just whatever you say in the moment with speech – You don't think about it. Like you say that all the time. You just respond to people.
Yeah.
But with writing, you're writing it down and reconsidering all the options, the differences.
Yeah, you have time to mull over the differences.
You could have responded. Got
it. Yeah. And so it says, even in the seemingly non-linguistic areas, so that's partly tactile, of the structures of consciousness and the unconscious, Derrida analyzes the underlying necessity that induces Freud to compare the psychic apparatus to a structure of scriptural difference and mystic writing pad. A mystic writing pad is another way of talking tactility, because mystic, you don't know, and then you got writing, so you don't know what you're writing, and it's a psychic apparatus about scriptural writing or scriptural tactility. So it's, again, a garbled attempt to make... It's very hard to make sense, visual, rational reason out of tactility.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's like trying to make the interplay of sense a sense.
Right, one of the senses.
Nice.
And then it's like translating Finney's Wake into Chinese. You don't do that. It's not one language. But when you get this, and McLuhan helps you see what tactility means, if you find the sentence that says tactility is not a sense, but the interplay, you have to read a lot of McLuhan to find that sentence, the needle in the haystack. Oh, that's what he means by tactility. It's not the actual pressured contact. It's the space being non-touching. But then it's also abrupt. So it's a paradoxical thing in itself. But once you know that, you can... Oh, insight?
Well, it makes me think of the formless... The matter, the form over matter, amorphous with the net and the shadow and all that kind of jazz.
That's Ganasco's sentence.
Yeah. Okay, shoot. What you just said made me think of that, because it's the tactility, which is the interplay, the in-between, but it's also, what did you say? It's also bracing or also...
Abrupt.
Abrupt.
It has contact. Yeah, it's half contact.
Yeah.
So if you're going to write that out, you'll produce crazy sentences like this. The illusion of the self-presence of meaning or of consciousness is thus produced by the repression of the differential structures from which they spring. Every one of his sentences is like this. And and actually, it's well done. Well, she's doing it. She's doesn't know what she's describing, but she's very good at fucking it up, which is... You have to fuck it up.
Differential.
You can't get it
differential.
Right.
Differential. Yeah.
Yeah. She writes a sentence. I don't know what that means, but it looks good. Then she goes on to the next incomprehensible sentence she makes up. I mean, look at this. The very fact that a word is divided into a phonic signifier and a mental signifier. Now, what's the difference? What's a mental? I have to presume something. It's like, well, there's no such thing as a mental unless I believe in metaphysics. But what is a mental signified in terms of brain chemistry? Versus a phonic signifier. Now, maybe today with their automated instruments, digital instruments, they can figure what part of the brain gets activated on the phonic versus the mental. But that's getting really fine-tuning, finding the root source of everything, which will be a little nothingness, which we'll know is the iCell. We've already been selling it for 50 years. And they'll claim, oh, we now have it. We have the invisible nothingness that everything came out of.
We'll as soon as there is meaning, there is difference.
Right. If you, that's visuality. Meaning means, they mean literally. Once you point out this is this and that isn't, and you can only do that by using your eye, when you start emphasizing the eye, there's a difference. It's not true as soon as there's meaning, there's difference, because there can be meaning in rhythm or significance for you that you respond to, you resonate with. That is another kind of meaning. And there may not be difference there. There may be harmony. So as long as they leave out the discussion of the senses, the way McLuhan does, if you do leave things like that out, you'll end up with a lot of abstract, one level removed from simple understanding of sensory action to conceptual variations. So they're actually writing. And so it's supposed to have a bunch of fucking indecipherable meanings because they're writing. That's what happens when you write something. You open it up to, if they were speaking it, they'd, maybe if they talk this stuff, Derrida would just quote McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
He'd just be simple and immediate and present. Say the facts are what McLuhan said. Now, if I'm going to write it, I'm going to disperse the meanings, the presence and obvious meaning or sense, and make it guessable. So you got three or four confusing levels of which way the meaning went.
It makes me think of Gene. You mentioned a couple coach houses ago that when Bob writes, you say, Bob, you write exactly what you mean, and it. What did you say? You were reading something, one of your posts on Facebook or something like that.
Yeah,
I think it was about maybe Buchanan or Trump or something. But it's like it's like the difficulty when you get a concept, when you get some sort of insight, and then you sit down to explain it, you know, that can be such a difficult task.
Yeah, because it's a different medium. You get the insight in the medium of your brain, inside yourself, I assume, you know, or maybe you see something. But you see a pattern that's a thought. And remember, all media come from thought, because thought is the content of speech. McLuhan calls it nonverbal mental gesture. Is the content of speech. So think of that.
I like that mental gesture. Oh, I like that.
Yeah, nonverbal mental gesture is a good definition of ESP.
That's really good.
Right. So he came up with those words in Counterblast, 1969. And so that's the first medium. Now you're going to translate to another medium. And if you're a normal numbskull, you don't recognize, this is totally distorted, because every medium distorts what I'm expressing. Every meaning will present it differently. So if you try, you're there juggling. Okay, I thought I had this pattern. This was the insight. Now, how do I write it? Well, I can't write it like I thought it. The writing's going to fuck with it because it's not the medium of thought, which is the brain, say, inside yourself, the interior landscape. So you end up making a garble, and you become a depressed intellectual who failed at communicating what you thought was significant.
Yeah, because as you're writing it down, you think up all kinds of more things.
Yeah.
And then it becomes Finnegan's Wake.
And that's like Ion. Ion is constantly verbalizing about the nonverbal.
Right, yeah.
That was, that's what I was going to say a long time ago. You were talking, Bob, about you want to get past the noun.
Yeah, the verb.
Right, the verb.
Yeah, the verb.
Bucky Fuller
brings up the predicate, always the term predicate, which
is
everything
the
past
object.
The noun, the doing part of the sentence.
I don't know. The predicate is the object of the doing. There's the subject,
the
verb,
object
and the predicate.
No, the predicate is what is being done to the object. The subject, the part of the sentence or clause containing a verb and stating something about the subject. So went home is the predicate for in the sentence, John went home.
So the predicate is something to do with the verb more than the object?
That's the part of the sentence containing a verb and stating something about the subject of the sentence. You identify the subject.
So subject the I?
Yeah, it's often the noun or the, you know, John. John went home. Yeah. John is the subject.
And went is the verb, and home is the predicate.
Went home is the predicate.
Well, that's how I'm defining predicate. It's the object, the goal, the direction.
Okay, okay. The object. All right. I was thinking the object of being the noun. But
the object
there's
is
a subject
the noun.
And the.
Well, no,
the
there's no object in there other than.
Right. Subject is the word.
Object. That. So that's maybe why a predicate is an odd object, a subtle, fucked up thing.
Well, from what I was thinking about ion, it's what the subject does. It's the doing part of the sentence.
Maybe
John
the intention.
John went home.
Well, the doing is winting, is going. Where it goes, home, is the object. Maybe the predicate is sort of like in the gap between the verb and the object. But it is.
I like that. It's like it's
yeah.
Like
I often don't know what
Ion
means when he says the predicate, how he uses it.
That's something that I've been thinking about too. And that's so when you were talking earlier about you want to get past the noun, I equated the noun with the subject part of the sentence.
Oh yeah, the noun. Yes, the noun is the tree went north. Yeah, the tree,
right.
The noun. And went is the verb, and where did it go is the object.
And the predicate is the...
Anyways, what about
the,
it? Okay, let's say we get what you mean. So what's your point?
Well, I just, again, I thought of Ion using that term, the predicate. And so I guess I want to re-listen to what you said there in relation to Ion using that word. Because that's what the only thing I recall, the specific words were, I want to get past the noun, is what you said. And I want to rehear that whole part.
Yeah. Well, let's ask Jason. He's read some of this stuff. So, Jason, what's predicate mean?
I have no idea. English is not exactly my best.
No. Now, Ion says there are a lot of, use that word in a lot of sentences. So, from you got to find out if you want to know what Ion means. If you listen to Ion.
Does it mean like a priori? Like a priori knowledge?
No, I mean, that means before. I don't think there's no beforeness in the object.
Well, it's like predicated on something. So it's like it's trying to.
Yeah, that's the second meaning.
That's the verb.
Yeah, you're right. It can mean that as well.
And what is that meaning? It's predictive?
Before.
Yeah, it's predicated upon something, a certain...
Yeah, went home. John went home. Where's the predication in there?
The predicate includes the main verb and all its modifiers.
Is home a modifier? Is that an adjective?
Yeah.
Went home, yes.
Home
is
the modifier.
Where he went. Home is
where so it's in the gap between the verb and the object, which
well,
becomes the adjective.
Well, the predicate's the whole thing.
I don't give a fuck. Let's move on. we don't know.
It
half
might
the words
you might have
use.
Just given a little clue, and so yeah, that's just something to ponder.
I mean, I don't know. If he had a grammarian come in here and precisely knew the difference and spelled it out, we may still not get it. I don't know. This is writing trying to describe what the song is. You got this rhythmic communication in the oral culture, and then writing comes in and tries to break it apart and say, well, this went there and that went over here, and this meaning stayed there, and this effect caused the war. You know, they're starting to visualize. I always like the image of a heart. You ever watch a heart pumping? You can't follow it on the eye level.
Oh,
unless you can, but I'm not able to do it. You know, the stuff's going
English.
In and going out at the same time.
Yeah, the pump, the action.
Yeah, the pumping action. It's hard to follow it.
It's expanding and contracting.
You start making graphs. You start making graphs of the with arrows showing the directions of different incoming blood, outgoing blood. That would be a pretty complex chart, maybe. A complex visualization.
Mm.
It's almost like McLuhan some people say modern postmodernism is just staying on the surface. McLuhan, as they play this at the beginning of the show occasionally, where I'm telling that if you actually try to figure out the phonetic alphabet did this or that that McLuhan says, you'll find it's not true. If you start to go into semantic resonances of things, you never get anywhere. So you end up with Derrida. But McLuhan just said, look, on the surface, the ear is different from the eye and it's different from the sense of touch. We've now externalized each of these sensory modalities. And if society seemed to go this way when it was eye and that way when it was ear, it might go this way when it's tactile. It's as simple, and that you don't start saying, well, what's tactile mean? And then you get into arguing, well, I don't know what, is that fast, blue, perfect? You know, you get into semantic fucking arguing, you, nothing gets resolved, right? Because always, you always bring your experience against someone else's experience, and they're always slightly different. So people have different nuances of sensory impression. So that enters the argument. So if you stay on the surface, okay, we're not going to get into whether this is true or not. But we can observe. It's hot over here and it's cold over there. What is cold? I don't know where cold came from. I don't know what part of my brain fucking registers cold. I don't know. Is that part of the brain? Well, no. This guy over there in that university tested the brain. The cold actually comes from your gut. You know? They start analyzing anatomy to figure out where cold is sensed in the brain. Well, we're not talking about that. We're just talking about sensory surface, the unreal. Cold is, you know, visual space, or cold is electricity. That's the level he's communicating on. It's actually rhetorical, like the art of rhetoric, where you say a bunch of stuff to influence people. Like, you know, okay, guys, we got to go over there. We're going to go over that mountain. Well, Bob, what is going to? Are we going to go by canoe or walk or run? And maybe I could use ESP. So you start equivocating like Nate does about the fucking statement. The group doesn't get to the mountain. Right? If you argue every word meaning. And then if you're a culture, and only all these different word meanings might be only a result of literacy. Because if you have all that stuff echoing in acoustic space and tribal people, no wonder they didn't even stay in their brain and had a bicameral mind of hallucinating spirits and everything talking to them. Nothing had organized it yet. No visual space had organized it. So they didn't have different meanings. They had different worlds in their perception. Get nice. That?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and they were all blended together, like the dream world and the real world, all it was all one.
Yeah, like Whittier told me.
No subconscious.
Right, subconscious caused by literacy. Writing is repression, starts to create the schizoid, which is subconscious, a split brain.
Yes. Earlier, but, you were talking about war. The organization of violence in war was a relief to people. And there was no relief required in what you're implying.
I don't know about that, but so Whittier told me that there are no opposites in some tribal people that said this. What's in common between the sun and the moon? And the native says, oppositeness. That's what's in common, the oppositeness. You know, and I don't know if that was a literate native person or what, the degree of perception, but it sounds like they wouldn't know there were opposites. Like, they don't know words aren't the object. The Eskimo says, I don't know stone unless I have the word stone. You must say stone before it's there. And that's ionic. You know, words create reality. Now, that's about as far as you can go with that. Start equivocating. You start saying, well, Bob, you never even went to school. You know, start making fucking personal accusations and discount what I just said. That's free for you to do. But only talk so far and then shut up. Now, if you're around a person who's shutting up too much, did talk too much to them. And you get them out of their rut. Except for when Ion's speaking. You got to pay attention to Ion.
Yeah, that's why psychedelics are so good.
Beg your pardon?
That's why psychedelics are so good. They get you out of your rut. They completely change your perceptual ratio towards your environment.
Right. Anything. Sleep does that. Gets you out of your rut. That's the original psychedelic. And now Dylan said in the late 60s, he said LSD is redundant. After a while, you just getting the same experience. So he didn't like that after a while. And that's what the Evergreen said. Mescaline, you get a new experience because it's a live thing. Every year you take it and you review your year, and it's a new perception. If you take LSD every year to review your life, you have the same chemical pattern.
Yeah, same with mushrooms and same with ayahuasca. They're more.
So they're like, do they repeat themselves, or are they like mescaline and create a new meaning?
No, they have like archetypal symbolism.
Patterns.
Like ayahuasca you'll be in the jungle even if you're taking it in New York City or something.
It has the same imagery run through.
Yeah, same with mushrooms. Mushrooms are very earthly, whereas LSD is like it's a clear, like, it's just you and your mind, whereas, like, mushrooms is definitely, like, you encounter another for sure. And you can communicate.
Okay, and that's different from mescaline? We're talking about mescaline is the good one.
Oh, I've never taken mescaline, so I can't comment on mescaline.
You're not qualified to be in this discussion. We're talking about mescaline, man. And you start talking about everything else. You're damn lucky this is a fucking oral society, oral medium, because if you were writing this letter, we would have thrown it away. If you were writing what you just said in a letter form, you wouldn't get away with this vagueness. But in the oral situation here, you can be vague and go off in another direction that I didn't know you were going in.
Okay, well, let's go back to the mescaline. Tell me about your mescaline trips there, Bob.
I never had any. No fucking way would I ever have mescaline. I never took drugs. I was just forced into drug land. Imprisoned me and poisoned me. All my drug tips were involuntarily taken. Assholes and Russians and intelligence agencies against me trying to fuck me up. That's what my drug trips were. And they all turned out to be pretty good anyways. It didn't work, whatever they thought they were going to do to me.
Oh, yeah, you learn more from the bad trips anyways.
You learn more from the bad trips? Well, I learned nothing then.
Well, yeah. That's pretty fucked up to drug somebody unwillingly.
Well, that happened in the intelligence circles all the time. That was working.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's an update of the oligarchs poisoning each other.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they had some crazy times, I'm sure, with, like, the two-way windows.
What are you sure of? Don't say I'm sure. You weren't even there. You don't fucking know, man. I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure Gordie Hall fucked with Bobby Hall's mother. I'm sure of that. Very sure of that.
Was
I haven't had a chance to ask Gordie Hall.
Was your earliest form of
Bobby
pharmacia,
Hall's
mother? Bob?
What? What? Pharmacia?
Yeah.
No, what did you just say?
I said
look,
it's fuck,
I think
it's
I think Alyssa's gone. Nate, what happened to Alyssa?
Oh, did she fall asleep? Alyssa.
No, up? I'm here.
Oh, good.
I'm taking my job.
There's only 1218.
It was just me.
Where's
now.
Nate? How did Nate get
he went
here?
To bed. He went to sleep.
Oh, I thought we were. Oh, that was Jason. Sorry. I mistook Jason for Nate. Okay. Gene, what were you saying?
I said this, the CIA poisoning of
everybody.
The intelligence agencies poisoning each other was the earliest form of pharmacia or pharmakia.
Pharmakia, right.
It's poison. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so do we go back and continue, sort of complete the paragraph or two, Alyssa? Do it logically, step by step through each part?
Yeah, should I read some more?
Yeah.
Or do you guys want to? You guys want to be done with the data? You've really wrapped them up, Bob.
Oh, did I put them away? Did I kill them for you?
I don't. No. I mean, hold on.
I've got you a way to think about it. Giving you a way to think about them.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's really nice to
to, well, remember a couple of co-classes ago when I was talking about the visual space and the new environment and all the bodies and the drama of cognition and how the visual space is always going to get you stuck. And then I was also listening to something else about the dividing and the dividing of like how this is really microscopic, and it's just like, it's good to not get confused by these things and think that you can come to some ultimate conclusion of what the person's saying. You know, it's like, so I'm happy to hear your long-range observations on it, and to kind of get that sort of simplicity. It's like a simple ground with McLuhan as the beautiful environment. You can see them like the funny little picture of them dancing in McLuhan's world, but trying to keep it all about visual space still. So.
Right. Yeah. McLuhan is speaking. So he's at a podium speaking, and everybody's not. And then you get a couple of people in the audience with their little slingshots, you know, throwing spitballs at him.
It takes the riddle quality like out of it, you know, and just kind of lets if I read more, it just becomes more of just a fun massage. I do like the tactility notes about how the difference and difference is trying to put a sense to something that's the interplay of sense. Liking this. It's giving me a lot of great material to approach this book with.
But
I don't read whole books right now. I just read parts of books.
Fragments,
And
that's why, you know, Mallerman. You should take one author. McLuhan's a good one, and read everything. Just take one author.
Yeah.
Someone recommended that.
Yeah.
And read everything so you know that one. And then all the rest, you know, you're just fragmented. And that's okay.
Yeah.
But you should know something. And really know everybody or somebody and everything they wrote.
I'm not going to do that to William Rowan Thompson because that didn't go very well. So McLuhan seems to be like the best. McLuhan and Croker are the most interesting to me right now. So it's good that you're covering that. It's great that you're covering it in these seminars.
I got a little question here. I started at 3. We've gone 5 hours. Bill and I'm saying we're going to go one more hour. And Bill's saying, so 2 hours and 3 minutes to go. I don't know. We're going one more hour anyways, Bill. One more hour anyways. Maybe more. Because we
1 hour and doing... 3.
1 hour and 3? What's that mean?
Minutes. Because it's a 57 of
that.
The hour.
Yeah, one more hour anyway. We're not ending this hour, is my point. So I'll send that to Bill. Because we usually go 6 hours, can go 7, and we're doing
five hours.
Yeah, and we've done 5, and we haven't even gotten to the book we were doing. But this is all good. What we're doing, very good. Shows that we could go, that I don't have to have a lot of prepared material. As long as you guys contribute, we can. There's all kinds of angles to go into this.
I'm appreciating this, Melissa.
Cool. Yeah, I'm appreciating all of the discussion around this. And okay, so let's keep going then.
I'll go another hour. Okay.
Derrida's project in his early writing.
Just a minute. So Bill keeps look. It's 8 o'clock. So that means it is 11 o'clock in California. And,
right. Normally, if you go this another hour beyond the hour we're just about to finish up, that will be the longest.
I've done 6 hours.
Yeah.
And that would be
the longest you've ever gone. If you go 1 hour
I think
beyond
I did
that.
7 the other day.
Yeah, 7 is the longest.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that might have been the time when we lost some of the recording then, because it's usually
maybe, but I think I did another one 7 hours. But Let me just check that.
The archives usually end at 11 p.m., which would be now. And then there are no